Do you know how Julia's doing?
She's still got COVID.
Yeah.
She's not showing up for her seminar later today, so.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I just wanted to see how she's feeling.
Energy to text, so,
sorry?
She's still got enough energy to text.
Okay, good. Okay, I forgot my book, so I'm going to be, unlike you, I'm going to be using an electronic device. All right. So I think we're mainly going to talk about Barnes today. I just want to say a couple things about some of the other poets that we're doing. I gave you, and it's worth looking at, the one Prayed poem that Rix puts in the anthology. It's not one of his comic poems, but he is a great comic poet. And so hang on to the, I can put a link also on Latte, but hang on to the handout that I gave you from on Monday. There's a reason that those two stanzas, that poem and its last two stanzas were the ones that I particularly wanted to look at. Let's just quickly to, there's a theme in Prayed, which you can also find in Bronte. Later on, I'll just say parenthetically, because we're talking about filiations and also elegies that poets wrote for their friends who had died before them, like Hardy's on Barnes. Later, we're going to look at Matthew Arnold's elegy for Emily Bronte, which is impressive that Arnold, who is unimpressive in so many ways, would do such a thing. But let's look at the Bronte poem on page 56. And just to get a sense of a certain quality that you'll find in a lot of these poems and that we were talking about a little bit on Monday, which is a sort of return to nature or an attitude towards nature that's occurring during a time of wholesale destruction of nature. So what happens is, as you all know, to give you the most potted of potted histories, is that the Industrial Revolution comes. One of the things that happens is that there are railroads all over England and all over Britain. There's manufacturing all over Britain. This is the kind of thing that Dickens is writing about in his novels. And what that means is that what the Romantics had already introduced, which is a fascination, wrong word, but intense communion with nature under the already falling shadows of modernization, becomes for a lot of Victorian poets an object of intense, not necessarily of nostalgia, but as a place of nostalgia. That is, a relation to nature can become a relationship to nostalgia itself. And that's something we'll talk about. As you know, the Brontes grew up on the heath, in the moorlands, and they write about the isolation and strangeness of that place, but they are also, Emily and Charlotte went and lived in Brussels, where Charlotte was a teacher. If you've read Villette, I don't think you have. I know some of you have read Jane Eyre, but probably haven't read Villette, Charlotte Bronte's other great novel. In some ways, maybe greater than Jane Eyre. That's not really true, but it's worth saying that to be provocative, because it's an amazing novel and not a novel that gets read very much. That is a novel about her experience in becoming a teacher in Belgium, in the village of Villette, which is a fictionalized name. And Emily Bronte, her younger sister, went with her and hated it. But there is, it's not like they grew up, lived, and died in the middle of nowhere. They were very much aware of everywhere and aware of what transportation and industrialization offered, but also what it was displacing. And so their intense view of nature, in a way, is one which, going back to what we were seeing in Tennyson, this isn't what they would have meant by it, but it is what it does describe a certain attitude, is that it's not, remember the line from Wordsworth, the woods decaying never to be decayed, or a line I didn't quote you from Wordsworth, but it's in the same list of what he saw as he was crossing Simplon Pass. It is, do you remember it? Do you know it? The Simplon Pass passage in the Prelude? It's fine if you don't. I'm just wondering because I know you're interested in Romanticism. It's the whole line is, the stationary blasts of waterfalls, the woods decaying, never to be decayed. So the idea is, yeah, waterfalls are always moving, and yet somehow they're a stationary blast. What would that mean? Just a quickly unpack that, the stationary blasts of waterfalls.
The core of it never goes anywhere, even though the water is always...
Yeah, yeah. So you take a picture of Niagara Falls, and then you take a picture a day later, and it's the same picture. If the light's the same and so on, it's the same picture. None of the water's the same, but the waterfall is the same. So for Tennyson, that's... So careless of the individual, so careful of the type. That is, everything is changing, but the agglomeration stays the same. This is often put as the every person in the crowd dies, but the crowd stays the same. If you look at the individual, so careless of the single individual, that's always changing. But what those individuals compose, they're always being replaced, but the composition is the same. The water drops are always different, but the waterfall is the same. And then Tennyson says, no, that's not true. What we've learned is that isn't true, thanks to geology, thanks to evolution, but also thanks to industrialization. And that's what I was talking about a little bit when I mentioned a poem that we're going to do later, Binsey Poplar's, which is, it's not simply that the woods are always the same, even though individual trees are being replaced. It's no, the woods are, to quote Hopkins, they're gone, are gone, are gone. He repeats it in this really movingly plaintive way. The landscape is changing. Matt, was your hand up? No, okay. So anyhow, just take a look, as I say, on page 56, a poem of memory of Emily Bronte's. It is the last poem on the left-hand page. Can someone read it? Mild the Mist, that one.
I can do it.
Okay. I have to get other people reading, but you do it this time.
Oh.
Yeah, go for it.
Mild a mist. Mild a mist upon the hill, telling not of storms tomorrow. No, the day has wept its fill, spent its store of silent sorrow. Oh, I'm gone back to the days of youth. I am a child once more. And neath my father's sheltering roof and near the old hall door, I watch this cloudy evening fall after a day of rain. Blue mists, sweet mists, summer pall, the horizon's mountain chain. The damp stands in the long green grass and thick as morning's tears, and dreamy scents of fragrance pass, that breath of other years.
That breathe of other years is a verb. Great, thank you. So yeah, it's a mild evening. It doesn't look like there's going to be a storm tomorrow, but it's not quite clear. Telling not of storms tomorrow, paraphrase that. So she looks around, mild the mist upon the hill, telling not of storms tomorrow.
So there's a mist on the hills, but it's not like too blinding, and it doesn't look like it was going to be heavy winter tomorrow.
Yeah, so the next day should be calm. The mist doesn't suggest there's going to be a storm the next day. Is there a kind of, I wouldn't say reverse, but obverse reading of that? So what do I mean by this? What do you mean by that? What I mean by that is there a suggestion here that the storms are now over? Or is there a suggestion that it's simply that they're not being announced? In other words, if you say, Trump said nothing about being helped by Russia, does that mean he wasn't helped by Russia, or does that mean he just didn't say anything about it?
Well, there is the saying, calm before the storm.
Uh-huh. Okay.
So I think it is likely that it's setting up for an atmosphere of a storm coming.
Yeah. And how would you, in human experience, know that there's a calm before a storm? If you learned that on your own rather than hearing it as an expression in English, how would you learn it?
Experiencing.
Yeah, what would you be experiencing?
Like pattern.
A pattern, yeah. That there's a calm, and the first time it happens, you think, yay, storms are over now. And then it turns out, well, actually, that's not true. So a way of asking this question is to say, what does the word tomorrow mean in line two of this poem? Is that a weird question? If we scale them as 1 to 5, this would be 2. Not 1, the easiest, but 2, reasonably easy.
The next day?
Okay, the next day, right? Tomorrow we don't have class. The Monday, Wednesday, Thursday classes do meet tomorrow, but we don't have class tomorrow. But what else does tomorrow mean in poetry? What's the most famous use of the word tomorrow in English poetry, in English literature? I know it's you can't just immediately say, what is he thinking? But what am I thinking?
Future, right?
What?
It means future.
It means the future in general, yeah. Tomorrow and tomorrow.
And tomorrow.
Right. What's that?
The Scottish play, Soil.
You can say Macbeth as long as you're not in a theater. Okay, everyone. People know that soliloquy? Macbeth. No? We used to have to memorize it back in the day when we did such things. Remember, by the way, let me remind you, you get extra credit for memorization in this class. So that's something you might want to talk to me about at some point. Maybe after you get your first paper back, you'll want to talk to me about it. Okay, so the soliloquy is, Macbeth hears that his wife has died. And he has a very ambiguous line. He says, she should have died hereafter. Which either means really inconvenient, now was not really the time for her to die, she should have held off a little bit, or the opposite, which is it doesn't matter. She dies now or she would have died later. So should have, can be, ought to have. Our word should goes both ways. It can be she ought to have died hereafter, or it can mean she would have died hereafter. So it's ambiguous what he means, but then he says tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow creeps in this petty pace from day to day to the last syllable of recorded time, and all our yesterdays have lighted fools the way to dusty death. So Macbeth, in despair at that point, is saying all of life is just tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow. It's not a big thing. It's not a vast reach of time. It's not a time of life. It's just tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow. Okay, so that is a use of tomorrow, something like what you're suggesting, which is that tomorrow means something like the future, not necessarily the immediate future. But why would we use the word tomorrow to mean the future in general? How do you think that happened in English poetry and then in English in general? You know, you talk about, you see it in commercials, right? Tomorrow's technology will let us all live to be 100. So you wake up tomorrow morning and it's like, where's this technology? No, what do you mean by tomorrow then? You mean in the future. Yeah, go ahead.
I was just going to say, in lieu of this poem, the word just with the analogy of storms could also be seen as, you know, don't talk to me about the issues. Issues are coming, talk to me about the here and now.
Okay, good. Yeah, so the here and now is it's all peaceful. Mild the mist upon the hill, telling not of storms tomorrow. Irina, is your hand up?
Yeah, seems more achievable if you say tomorrow as to just, like, the future.
You mean, like, is...
I understand what tomorrow is, and, like, just, like, psychologically, I have a pretty good conception of what tomorrow will look like, so associating, like, we were saying, like, in a commercial or, like, in this poem, it's easier for me to, like, accept whatever message is being put forward.
Okay, good. So, in general, it's when it's used as a promise, it's used as you won't have to wait long for this fantastic new technology, because it's really coming tomorrow. Or, you know, it's going to be a bright new day tomorrow, something like that. She's not using it in an optimistic way here, though. So all I want to point out, it's, I think, a really interesting thing, is to say that telling not of storms tomorrow could mean the storm is over and tomorrow will be a nice day. Like at the end of Wuthering Heights, which ends on a nice day. Those of you who've read it will remember. Quite a surprise that it should be a nice day when Wuthering Heights ends, but that's the point. It ends on a nice day. On a nice day. So, okay, there was a storm. But now the day has wept its fill. What does that mean? It's a metaphor. Yeah.
It's already been stormy today.
Yeah, it rained all day. Done. Yeah, it's done. It's wept its fill. It's had its expression of grief and sorrow, spent its store of silent sorrow. So the day has finished its weeping, which means there was a storm today. She is reading the weather emotionally. This is known by someone that we will see allusions to, John Ruskin, who is the great art historian of the 19th century, who championed Turner. So if you know Turner's paintings, one reason that Turner was so successful, even though he challenged so much of the history of art in the Victorian era, is that John Ruskin said he is the absolute greatest, which he was. And so Ruskin has a famous book called Modern Painters, which is one of the two or three most important books in the history of, in developing the discipline of art history, of Western art history. Anyhow, Ruskin has a term which you should know, which is the term is the pathetic fallacy. And what the, have you ever heard that term? So it's not, oh, that fallacy is just pathetic. What the pathetic fallacy is a way that we have of ascribing to inanimate objects, to natural objects, human emotions. So he will, one example that he gives is the phrase, totally common phrase we've heard all the time, a raging fire, as though the fire were angry. It's raging, but it's not. It's just burning. And it may be burning not furiously, because that would be the pathetic fallacy, but just with a great deal of energy, if you were talking about it the way a chemist a chemist would talk about it, the way a communist chemist would talk about it. Yeah.
Is the pathetic fact, is that supposed to still bring on the negative connotation?
No.
Yeah, no. I was going to say, like, how do we describe fires without emotion?
Yeah, so the fallacy is that there are certain situations where we ascribe and project our own emotions or our own readings of other people's emotions onto inanimate objects, and that's a very common metaphorical use of language. And in poetry, it can get intensified. In literature, it can get intensified, but it's a very common metaphorical use of language. And then you get it, you know, you can say it also goes the other way, that it, the word cold might be the pathetic fallacy, oh, the weather is so cold, as in it doesn't care about us. Or it might be that we are using a natural metaphor to describe a human lack of emotion, how cold you are when I tell you my problems. So it goes both ways. But the term to know, it's not particularly important for this poem, but it's just, it's important for what we're covering in this class. The term to know is the pathetic fallacy. So here it's, the day has wept its fill, spent its store of silent sorrow. Has it? Are days sorrowful? Do they weep? No. So who's feeling sorrow? Why would she read it that way? You'll know what Rorschach tests are, right? Mm-hmm. So the way they're supposed to work, they don't. But the way they're supposed to work is what you see reveals your personality, as the internet quizzes used to say. So you just see a blotch on paper and you say, yes, that looks like someone who is feeling extreme rage over the fact that they got a B minus on a paper. What is that telling you about the person who reads it that way?
He's anxious about schoolwork?
Yeah, or unhappy with a grade or something like that. Or what if, why, yes, that looks like a C plus, then they're anxious about the grade they're going to get, something like that. So the idea would be the emotions that you impute to something that is not emotional, to some natural object, what you impute reveals how you're feeling. Your imputations come out of a perspective that is caused by your feelings. Okay, that makes sense to people, right? So what can you say about her then? Yeah.
She was sorrowful and has, like, finished her weeping for the day.
Yeah, and that somehow it's, she's also guided by the weather. So the weather, it's a back and forth, which is, yeah.
Is there a term that describes that phenomenon that, like, the environment matches the energy? Like how you said in movies, it, like, rains when it's super dramatic at the end? Or
yeah, So there's a harmonization of imagery. I don't think there's a particular term, but the idea of the harmonization of imagery is something that people have been thinking about since at least the 18th century. I'll try to think if there's an actual term for it. But what happens is, and I think this is what you're suggesting too, is they get into a kind of sync. That is, the weather is appropriate for how I feel, but that also means that as the weather changes, it can, because I'm in sync with it, it's in sync with me, but that means I'm in sync with it, and now it can guide me. So there's a way that that experience of guidance, of this perfectly illustrates how I feel, and now because it illustrates how I feel, I will follow it. So I choose it to follow. That's what I choose to follow because it's how I feel, but I am following it. So as it modulates, I can modulate as well. which in a way is an explanation for why there's so many metaphors in poetry, why there's so much pathetic fallacy, why there's so much projection. Because it's not, oh, right now I'm angry and there's an angry storm going on outside. Oh, but the storm is calming down, so I better go look at the angry fire that is burning so furiously. Oh no, the fire is going out. I better turn on the TV and look at an angry politician. In other words, we don't hop from thing to thing, but we can get sufficiently connected with it that the connection is helpful expressively. That is, this expresses how I feel, but it's also helpful in developing the arc of my feelings. I can follow that thing which expressed how I felt so much. So again, you can think music works this way kind of preeminently. That you listen to music and there's a mood in the music and it might be just the right mood for you. And then the music develops and the mood changes and it can take you with it. So you might pick a song, a tune, a piece. But then the piece, after you've picked it, can bring you places that maybe you wouldn't have gone alone. So it's just a very quick theory of how metaphor works. So yeah, what you can guess is the weather was perfect for how she felt. And now you can tell that the fact that the weather is modulated into mildness is also suggesting that her feelings have modulated. But telling not of storms tomorrow, first of all, means, okay, so tomorrow will be a brighter day. But it may also mean, I know this is temporary. That is, what happens when storms end is it looks like they're over for good. But I know that they're not. That when you see a calm day, that does not mean that warm days will never cease, that calmness will never cease. It just means that that calmness is one in which you can rest for a moment. But she knows that there are storms coming tomorrow, which doesn't mean February 2nd, but does mean in the future and in the not too distant future. We don't say, yes, tomorrow is, I will graduate tomorrow. But we might say something like, no more work tomorrow. But, or telling not, I don't know, it's not something we use that much in ordinary speech, but we do use it rhetorically. So she knows there will be further storms. And that gives her a step back from the very image that she is also harmonizing with. And I think the two meanings of that line, telling not of storms tomorrow, gives you that. That is, okay, that means there are no storms tomorrow, and I can be calm for a while. But it also means this calmness isn't the absolute truth. It's just a temporary truth. It is calm. It isn't a sign that there'll be storms tomorrow, but it's also temporary. So, and then that brings her back to the days of youth. It's calm. So, looking at the future, she returns to the past. Oh, I'm gone back to the days of youth. I am a child once more, and 'neath my father's sheltering roof, and near the old hall door, comma, so we get a continuation from stanza to stanza, the equivalent of an enjambment, but not literally an enjambment because there is a comma there, but usually stanzas and period and sentences end at the same time. But here we have, and near my father's sheltering roof and near the old hall door, I watch this cloudy evening fall after a day of rain. So it's as though she's remembering what it was like when there were rainstorms and she was a child. And so it brings her back to that, brings her back to that experience. But that then again tells you that in the future, there are going to be more rainstorms, because now we're in a present where she imagines herself in a past, which means that the present is the future of that past. And what has happened in the future of that past? There's been a rainstorm again, and there's been weeping of silent sorrow. Okay, does that make sense? I'm going through this a little bit fast, but it's just there's a, if you've seen the Rian Johnson movie Looper, it's a little bit like Looper. So I think I may be the only person who's ever compared this poem to Looper, but there you go. She's back as a child. Blue mists, sweet mists of summer pall the horizon's mountain chain. So pall there means covers over, blur and make it hard to see the horizon's mountain chain. So the horizon's mountain chain, that's what's far away. The chain, and the word chain, just feel a little bit of its resonance. That is, you get chained up, the chain of years. The damp stands in the long green grass as thick as morning's tears. So it's as though morning is weeping, and that morning did weep. And dreamy scents of fragrance pass that breathe of other years. So she's just remembering that past, dreaming of other years. Okay, let's go forward a little bit. I just want to say something quickly about Thomas Hood. I don't know how carefully you read Miss Kilman's Egg and Her Precious Leg, but it really is worth reading. Some of it is going to be obscure to you, but you can Google some of it. It doesn't really matter. The obscure parts, it's just worth getting a sense of. And this is, Hood was a very leftist poet, and he's most famous for a poem that we don't have called The Song of the Shirt, which is a song sung by a woman who is doing the really terrible scut work of sewing. She's sewing a shirt, and she's describing the pain of the working class in doing manufacturing and the difficulty that they're experiencing. It was an important poem among leftist agitators, leftist political figures, working class political figures. This poem is a poem about the absurdity of the super rich. Some people have suggested that this poem actually applies really well to Trump. Anyhow, it's funny. The Song of the Shirt is not funny. This is a funny poem because Miss Kilman's Egg eventually gets... do you remember what happens to her? So she's murdered. What?
Murdered by her golden leg.
Murdered by and for her golden leg. Yes. So... she wants a leg of gold. Well, if you have a leg of gold and someone takes it off you and hits you really hard on the head with it, the pun he makes is leg and legate or legacy. That's going to be your leg-a-cy. And it's all this wealth leads to revenge. Hood was just to mention it. Hood was a friend of Thackeray's, and Thackeray really, really liked him. But Hood was leftist, whereas Thackeray was not. Okay, let's go to the poem called Childhood. This is William Barnes, and it's page 80. It's poem number 78. So except for, I think, one poem in the selection we did for today, but there are actually subtle things to say about this. Do we have time for that? Nah. Yeah, okay, so hang on to the poem Childhood. We'll go back to it in a minute. I just want to show you go to page 87 and look at the poem called The Fireside Chairs. Were people able to get used to his dialect and spelling? Like, if you see that, I'm not even going to try to pronounce it, but the fireside chairs, that's what that word, fireside, means. Okay, so just go forward one more page to the poem called Seasons and Times, which is kind of a fun poem because what he's doing is doing really long rhymes, what are called hudibrastic rhymes, where you have polysyllabic rhymes. And the rhymes in that poem are strew on the ground, shoe on the ground, hue on the ground, dew on the ground, through on the ground, new on the ground, and few on the ground. And if you just to notice about that poem, it's written in standard English. A while in the dead of winter, the wind hurries keen through the sunshine, but finds no more leaves that may linger on tree boughs to strew on the ground. And now if you go back to the fireside chairs, you can notice that some of the lines are standard English. Arguably line one, though he does give a little bit of dialectic pronunciation to gain. Though days do gayen upon the night, and birds do make a lieter flight, 'tis cold enough to spread our hands, oons now and then to glow in brands. So days do gain upon the night, what would that mean? What time of year is it?
Summer?
Well, it's still cold, so it's not summer.
So spring.
Early spring, yeah. The days are getting longer. So though days do gayen upon the night, and birds do take a later flight, so they're flying later in the day, still, 'tis cold enough to spread our hands, oons now and then to glow in brands. So most of it's a dialect, but notice he's addressing his wife, and look at line 9, where you shall have the window view. So standard English, or line 20, if I could look on you, my bride, or lines 24 and 25. So starting line 23, and there's the nap, and then no dialect, where we did rove at dusk along the high-treed grove, and the while the wind did whisper down our whispered words. And it's almost as though the poem is being drawn into a different kind of rhetoric. And then he goes back to dialect. And there's the crown of Duncliffe Hill with wooden shades of wood cast on slope and gliade. So if you were an actor reciting this, you would have to keep a dialectic language all the way through. But part of what's interesting about Barnes is reading him rather than hearing him read aloud. You might think dialect poetry should be experienced aloud, but I actually think it's the opposite. That is, of course he knows how to spell these words. And if he writes them out in dialect, it's because he wants the strangeness of the way the words look on the page, the strangeness of the way we sub-vocalize them, to be strange. If you spoke only dialect, but you could read and write, what you would do is the way you would write the word fire if you spoke with a strong dialectical accent. How would you spell it?
Would be using the A-E, F-A-E-R-E.
Nice, but I'm just assuming you're... So take a version of this would be anyone from New Zealand or Australia? Okay, so you know that Australians have what we regard as a very strong accent, and we have what they regard as a very strong accent. So if you were Australian and you wanted to write the word Australian, how would you write it? This is number one. Yeah, A-U-S-T, right, exactly. How do we hear them pronounce it? Well, we would write how we hear them pronounce it as S-T-R-I-N-E, Strine. That person there is Strine, right? Because that's how they say Australian, Strine. But they would never write it that way. They would think, yeah, A-U-S-T-R-A-L-I-A-N, Strine. That's how you spell it. What's the problem? Okay, does that make sense to people? That is that if you're reading like English literature parodying American accents, it's hard for us to read it because we don't know what they're saying until we say it out loud and then we realize that it sounds the way we speak. But if you've ever had that experience of, George Bernard Shaw does this, you ever had the experience of reading someone parodying an American accent or making sure you know that someone is speaking with an American accent, it's only an English reader who's going to say, oh, wait, yeah, obviously that's an American accent. An American reader is going to say, what is this? I can't make sense of it. But if it were spelt in standard English and we read it aloud, then an English reader would say, yeah, you're really getting that American accent, as though it had been spelt that way. Okay, makes sense to people? So the point is, if you speak in dialect, if you write in dialect, and you don't know how to pronounce standard English because this is your accent, but you know how to read and write, you are just going to spell fireside, or you're going to spell what you pronounced fireside, or fireside, you will spell it F-I-R-E-S-I-D-E. So in a way, what he's doing in this poem is showing an interplay between standard ways of spelling and pronouncing and dialectical ones. And that interplay has a little bit of a sense of nostalgia to it. It's as though, yes, I'm educated. I speak standard English. But I, nevertheless, my poetry, what I want to do when I express myself poetically is express myself in the non-standard pronunciations of my youth. And in order to do, but because those are no longer my pronunciations and no longer my spelling, what I have to do is spell it the way the sounds of standard English would be used to give a transcription of the dialect that I grew up with. So does that make sense to people? To clarify a little bit, it's like if you're reading Mark Twain and you get stuff in dialect, or if you're reading Thomas Hardy and you get stuff in dialect, or you're reading Emily Bronte and you get stuff in dialect. The point is the stuff in dialect allows someone who has standard pronunciations to hear for themselves what the people in the story sound like to someone who speaks standard English. So, you know, just if you're reading something and the G's are replaced by apostrophes. Then I seen her darnin' a sock. We would say darnin' because we see the G is missing, but the speaker would just think, yeah, it's the word darning, and that's how you say it. If you see D-A-R-N-I-N-G, you say darning, because that's how you say it. In fact, there's evidence that Shelley pronounced I-N-G without the G. You will sometimes see Shelley rhyming words that end I-N-G with words that end I-N, and for him, they're perfect rhymes. So we can also reconstruct his pronunciation. you can reconstruct Shakespeare's pronunciation by looking at words that rhyme, that don't rhyme for us, but that rhymed for Shakespeare. And so it's not like, oh yes, how strange, they don't rhyme. It's, oh yes, this is how Shakespeare pronounced the word. So the way Mark Twain pronounces darning is, or the way his character pronounces darning is darnin. But if the character is literate, they would still spell it darning. If they write you a letter, they're not writing you a letter in dialect spelling. If they're literate enough to write a literate letter, it's going to be in ordinary spelling, but if they read it aloud, it'll be in dialect. And so for someone like Twain or Hardy or Bronte or Barnes, the point is that they now have two languages, the language of their youth and the language of their adulthood. And because they are writing for other adults, they are expressing the language of their youth in spelling that wouldn't have been natural to them when they first learned to read and write. When Barnes was a kid and he learned to write the word fire, he learned it as F-I-R-E. And he only starts spelling it V-I-E-R when he's trying to convey a pronunciation which he knows is not standard. So the very fact that he's writing these poems in dialect, the same is true of Robert Burns, the very fact that they're writing these poems in dialect is a sign, as in the Bronte poem that we looked at, of those days being past. So now, go back to that poem, Childhood. And I won't, well, does anyone want to try it? With a dialectical pronunciation? Really? All right, Irina, go for it.
It's a disaster, but I'll try.
Oh, wait, yeah, let me just ask you, as a Canadian, do you have that experience of, like, American pronunciation or of Americans making fun of Canadian pronunciation with spelling?
What do you mean? Like,
there, you know, there's some words.
Like OU?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what's an example?
Like neighbor, favorite.
Yeah, so now you're doing the American pronunciation.
I am.
Yeah. Neighbor? Oh,
we say neighbor in Canada.
Okay, but what's a Canadian word that
like babe. Yeah, like that's like my babe.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
Which is like for us very Midwestern.
Yes, yeah,
or
exactly.
Like sorry.
Sorry, yeah, yeah. Sorry, yeah. Sorry, that's a good one.
Yeah.
So how do you spell sorry?
S-O-R-R-Y.
Right. And how would an American saying, ha, you're Canadian, spell it? Really? S-O-A-R-Y, something like that.
Yeah.
So that's a local example. Good. Okay, so yeah, go for Childhood.
Okay. I at the time, our days were but new.
Okay, so...
New? I don't...
Yeah, meaning what in standard English?
Few.
Few, yeah. Okay, good.
And our limbs were but small and a grown... And then the
fier
world were new, and life were all hopeful and gay, and times of the sprouting of leaves, and the vernant seasons of moan, and binding oh redhead. I have no idea.
All right. I'll put.
We're all welcome seasons away.
A J. Okay. Quinn, did you want to? Were you volunteering?
Yeah, for the second.
Go.
Minute,
go for it.
Fun.
Yeah.
The thousand seemed high, the below, and the brook did seem wide, that is narrow,
and time that we flee to go slow, and villains now be feeble or strong. I can only think of this like an old man's voice.
That's okay.
In our world, it's in with the names of the Shrewsbury Hill or Bowborough.
Uh-huh.
In life, it seemed only the games that we played as the days rolled along.
Great, thank you. Anyone else want to try their, I won't say their hand at it, their mouths at it? Yes, you do admit it. Go for it.
Then the rivers and high timbered lands and the silvery hills without, I cannot guess what this one is.
Okay, so part of what you have to do is guess what the words mean in order to figure out the dialectic pronunciation. It's a fact, an interesting linguistic fact about human language, that we can imitate accents that are different from ours. And it's not like if you want to imitate an English accent, you have to have heard every word that you're imitating. It's just you can internalize the accent, especially if you know what the word means. So it's buying, B-U-Y-I-N-G.
Okay.
And the Silvery Hills, without buying, without buy-in.
Buying did seem to come into our hands from others that owned them afore.
Yeah, so what would that be in standard English?
From others who owned them before.
Yeah, yeah, okay. Yeah. Or the aforementioned would be pronounced the avore-mentioned. So, yeah, others that owned them avore.
Avore. And all sickness and sorrow and need seem to die with the world.
Okay, so "old" there means old.
Yeah.
So, old. So what do you think? Anyone? What does "old folk a dying" mean?
Old folk.
Yeah, the old folk a dying. Good.
And leave us forever a three long evils our forefathers bore.
Good. Yes. Good.
I just have a question.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So, along with the writing style, was like transforming into an adult who spoke standard English as well a thing, or were people still speaking like the dialects of their childhood?
It's a thing if you become if you become educated, if you become a vicar, if you become an academic, as he did, if you end up being able to read 60 different languages.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not a thing for most people, but it's a thing for some people. And what, you know, if I think no one's read Jude the Obscure. You've read it?
Yeah, I've read it.
Yeah, so it's a thing for Jude, right? That is that here is a person who gets educated, as Thomas Hardy himself got educated, which means that there's now a linguistic gap between, let's call it, your mother tongue, the tongue that you grew up in and were nurtured in, and the literate tongue that you now have. And so that is not something trivial. That sense, you know, as first-generation Americans like me, and I think like some of you, know that you may or may not hear your parents' accents, but you definitely hear your grandparents' accents. And that's a gap. That's a difference, and for good and for evil. The language that was the language of comfort and belonging is now also a language that education has estranged you from. And I think this is true in all sorts of contexts where the difference between the way children are educated and the way their parents were educated something that they become aware of. If you've read Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man, that's very much a thing in the first part of Invisible Man. So that is a, you know, the loss of childhood, alienation or strangeness, a difference from the days of youth, which is what Emily Brontë was talking about, one aspect of that can be if you come from something other than I won't even say the dominant culture, but the absolutely authoritative culture. So dominant not in terms of numbers, but in terms of class and power. Joining that culture or being taught, being assimilated into that culture, comes with a feeling of linguistic estrangement from the language in which you took the most comfort as a child. So that is one of the things that he's, I think, explicitly writing about here in this very poem. Okay, so someone want to do the last stanza? Just one more stanza, come on, we can do it. Everybody looking thoughtful. Oh, yeah, go. Yeah, try.
Quinn can do it again.
Quinn already did it.
I can do it because I'm your friend.
Yes.
All right, okay.
That some hymns or others must do, like the low-headed shrubs that be born.
Wait. Happy be children.
Oh, I thought you said the last stanza.
It is the last stanza.
Oh, you're right. But happy be children that the while that have elders of living to love them and take all the wearisome toil that some hands or others must do. Like the low-headed shrubs that be worn in the loot of the trees up above them, a screen from the cold-blown storm that the timber of Mora must root.
Okay, good. Nice. So this is not, well, in a way it's like Bronte's poem. I'm just going to say something quick about it because the poem I really want to get to is what we're about to get to. But it's a memory of childhood, but notice it's not a naive memory of childhood, as many poems about childhood are. It doesn't mean that the poets are naive when they write about childhood, but many poems about childhood are naive. Take a naive speaker, because childhood is a time of naivete. So think of something like, everyone knows Tiger, Tiger, Burning Bright. Is this familiar to people? So famous poem by William Blake that begins, "Tiger, tiger, burning bright in the forests of the night. What immortal hand or eye could frame thy fearful symmetry?" And that belongs to a book of Blake's called Songs of Experience. And Songs of Experience is part two of a book of Blake's called Songs of Innocence and of Experience. And a lot of the poems in Songs of Innocence are paired with Songs of Experience. So the song, and some of them actually have the same title, like Holy Thursday. And the idea is the Songs of Innocence are songs sung by children on the whole who don't know how terrible the world is. And then the Songs of Experience are songs that are sung by cynical, sometimes bitter, sometimes grief-stricken people who have learned what the world is really like. And so the Tiger is probably the most famous of Blake's Songs of Experience. I just recited the first stanza for you. It is paired in the Songs of Innocence, or what it pairs in the Songs of Innocence, does anyone know? Is a poem called The Lamb. So the last line of the penultimate stanza of the Tiger, it's about God and how did he create the tiger? What immortal hand or eye could frame thy fearful symmetry? He asks of God, did he smile his work to see? Did he who made the lamb make thee? So God who made the lamb, he also made the tiger? What's up with that? Why would he do that? That's one of the questions in The Tiger. The way The Lamb goes is it's a very much a song of innocence. And it goes, little lamb, who made thee? Dost thou know who made thee? Gave thee life and bred thee, feed through the dale and o'er the mead. gave thee clothing of delight, soft as clothing, woolly bright. Little lamb, who made thee? Dost thou know who made thee? And then the answer is, the Lamb of God made you. Someone who is meek and mild. He is meek and he is mild. He became a little child. Thou a lamb and I a child. We are both called by his name. Little lamb, God bless thee. Little lamb, God bless thee. So the child's voice there is, oh, this lamb, it's so sweet. And God creates the lamb and it's just wonderful and life is good. And it's not life is good because I can see that it. Some people might think it's evil, but it isn't. It's just life is purely good without my even having to need a sense of contrast with that. I'm so innocent that I would say that. And then, little lamb who made thee turns into, did he who made the lamb make thee? So, yeah, no, God is also making tigers that rip lambs apart and consume them. So that's the discovery of the adult. But here, what we get is an account of childhood, but very much from the adult's perspective. So he's remembering, as Bronte remembers, childhood. I, at that time, our days were but few. So I'm not going to pronounce it too dialectically, but just go through it one more time. And our limbs were but small and a growing. So we were little, but we were getting bigger. And then the fair world were new. So the world was new to us. The fair world was new. And life were all hopeful and gay. And the times of the sprouting of leaves and the cheek-burning seasons of mowing and binding a red-headed sheaves were all welcome seasons of jay. So every season was welcome at the time. So the time of the sprouting of leaves, that would be, you're our season expert. When do leaves sprout?
Early spring.
Early spring. And the cheek burn in seasons of mowing. So when do you mow the grain?
Fall.
Yeah, fall, late summer or fall. And the binding of red-headed sheaves, that is when you bring everything you've mown together into sheaves. So that would be harvest time. They were all welcome seasons of joy. So even though time is passing in childhood, it's not the standard metaphor, well, it used to be spring, but now it is autumn. It's, they were all seasons of joy. That was childhood. Within this idea of the cycle of time is a timeless feeling. But when do you have that timeless feeling that it's all good? When your days are but few and your limbs are but small and a growing, which means growing into adulthood, but still growing. So all of that was good. Then the housing seemed high that be low. So paraphrase that or just interpret that, translate.
When you're small, everything looks big.
Yeah, and the houses seem big. That, in fact, are low. So that tells you that this is an adult describer, right? Then the housing seemed high that be low. And the brook did seem wide that I now know is narrow. And time that do flee did go slow. So time is always flying, but then it went slow. And feelings, now feeble, were strong. So emotional feelings, love, hope, all those things were strong then. And our world did end with the names of the Shasbury Hill or Bull Barrow. So just these local places, that was the end of the world. We never got farther, but it was the whole world. And life did seem only the games that we played as the days rolled along. So life seemed to be only games. Then the rivers and high-timbered lands and the silvery hills without buy-in did seem to come into our hands from others that owned them afore. So we seemed to own them. We didn't have to buy them. They were ours. It was our world. And all sickness and sorrow and need seemed to die with the wold folk a-dying. So the old people died, and that was fine, because that's when sickness and sorrow and need also died. Yeah, we saw old people. Grandmother was sick. She had tuberculosis. She died. But I was a child, and then everything was good. And leave us forever freed from evils our forefathers bore. So again, that experience of childhood is not, you don't see people get old and sick and die. It's not meaningful to your own experience of life. Yeah, it's sad that they die, but it's not like, oh, and this will happen to me sometime. So this is a pretty accurate memory of early childhood that he's giving you, of the mood, the feeling of early childhood, that even the terrible things that happen, and they are terrible, they're not about you. You are not part of the population to whom terrible things happen. Or if you are a part of that population, you are not typical of that population, because it's you and your friends, it's the kids. And then what I think is really an amazing last stanza, but happy be children the while they have elders a-living to love them. So let them be happy while they have elders a-living to love them. So it's good that children feel this way. And take to love them and to take all the wearisome toil, and elders a-living to love them and to take all the wearisome toil that some hands or others must do, like the low-headed shrubs that be warm in the luth of the trees up above them. So there's a note on luth, which is essentially a sheltered place from the cold. A screen from the cold blowing storm that the timber of forum must rue. So now as adults, what do we do? What should we do? We shouldn't be bitter about childhood cluelessness about what life is really like. It's great that they feel this way. And even if they're only, because we remember how great it was, and even if they're only going to feel this way for a little time, it is our task, the task of us adults, to be the trees protecting the children from the storm, to let them live in this illusion for the very short amount of time that they will have this illusion, that the days are not many, that they don't know that they don't really know that they're actually going to turn into adults like the adults with all their adult problems. And there's no resentment of children for not knowing how hard life is, which is a standard thing for adults to do. Oh, you children, you think it's all fun and games. But it's not. There's no resentment of that. There's rather a duty that he's describing. And it's not a bitter duty. You could imagine this as a poem of bitter nostalgia. Like, I can't believe how wrong I was. It's terrible. Many poems like that, it's terrible how you're fooled into thinking that life is okay when you're a little kid. And it makes you bitter, many poems say, when you find out that that was all falsehood. But that's not what he's saying. He's saying this is exactly what we should be doing. The modern novel, which takes this point of view, or at least has its main character take this point of view, as he thinks of a poem not by Barnes, but of Robert Burns, the other great dialect poet, might be the adult who's protecting the children who are running through the rye. And what is the adult protecting them from doing? because they're at a cliff's edge. So what he has to do is, and they don't know it, is he has to catch them. So he thinks of himself as...
Catch her breath.
Yeah, that's Holden Caulfield, thinking that that's what he would want to be. He's no longer the child, but as the catcher in the rye. Have people read it? Is this still... Yeah, so that's that image of being the catcher in the rye. He's protecting his little sister Phoebe in that way, or trying to. And just imagining protecting all the children who are running through the rye who have no idea. But it's good that they have no idea. And it's his own memory of childhood that he now wants to honor in others and give others that experience. Yeah?
Isn't it in a Thomas Hardy book that a man loses his entire fortune because all of his sheep run off the cliff?
Yeah.
That's a very different adulthood.
Yes, exactly. Okay, so go one page further to the poem called The Turnstile. And this is just to say an unbearably sad poem. So do you know what a turnstile is, what it would be in England in the 19th century? It's a little bit like a subway turnstile, but not quite. All right, what's a subway turnstile? Or as we say in England, the tube. What's a tube turnstile? Yeah.
A little metal clanky thing that you walk through. I know that's an extremely scientific term. But...
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's very scientific.
They all go like that now because London got modern.
Yes. But a turnstile is basically you pass through it by pushing it and it circles round. And why do they have them in England? Do people know why they have them in the countryside? If you go hiking in England, you'll still see them all over the place, right in the middle, right on a path going through the countryside. You'll come to a fence and there'll be a turnstile there, and that's the only way through the fence is by going through the turnstile. Then you get to the other side of the fence. You're not paying or anything, so why are they there?
Is it for livestock?
Yes, it's so that the livestock can't get through. So it lets humans through, but not livestock. You have to be able to fit between two arms of the turnstile to go. You also have to know how it works, that you're pressing it. I think it's always counterclockwise, but I don't know why. So it's a feature of landscape, turnstiles are. So here we go. Ah, sad were we as we did pace the wold church road with downcast face. The while the bells that moaned so deep above our child, a left asleep, were now a zingin' all alive with t'other bells to make the vibe. Someone want to try to paraphrase that? Or all of you together, work on paraphrasing it. Okay, I'll begin. Ah. Then what? Yeah.
Is it about parents marching their child towards inevitable demise?
Ultimately, but just paraphrase. Let's do it line by line. Sad were we as we did march our children towards inevitable demise. No, I'm not seeing it in those lines. So, oh, you don't have a copy, right?
No, sir.
Print it out. Okay. Do you, just let me ask, do you need me to scan the next portion, the next Pasha? Okay. All right, so for those who do have it, or if you can share, Karina. Sad were we? Okay, what does that mean?
We were sad?
Yes, how sad we were, let's say, as we did pace the Wold Church Road with downcast face. So what does pace mean?
Walk.
Yeah, or pace. So we were sad as we did pace the wold. What we already know what wold means, right? From the previous poem, what does it mean?
Old.
The old church road with downcast. Downcast what?
Face.
Good. The while the bells that moaned so deep. So as we were walking, what did they hear?
Church bells.
That moaned so deep above our child, a left asleep. So the church bells were moaning deeply above The child who has died. So that was his 2-year-old son, Julius, who died. And he's now describing, so I just should tell you that this is a poem written after the death of his 2-year-old son, Julius, and also after the death of his wife, Jenny. So the while the bells that moan so deep above our child are left asleep. So he's remembering the funeral, the bells that moaned over, that rang the dirge of his child. So we were sad as we paced the road, hearing the bells that moaned so deep above our child left asleep, but the while the bells were now a zingin, all alive with t'other bells to make the vibe. So we were sad, even though now the bells were all alive. They were the same bells, but they were all singing alive with other bells to make the vibe. So they were, it's in fact the next day, and the church, they're hearing the same church bells, but the church bells now are tolling some celebration. Come to Mass, it's time to come to church. It's no longer the dirge of the funeral bells. So they are hearing the bells as they walk the church road with downcast face. They might be going to church because he was a vicar, and they do that. But the bells are no longer appropriate to their mood. They were the day before when they buried their child, but no longer. But up at one place we come by, 'twere hard to keep one's two eyes dry. So there's a particular place where not only are they sad, but what else are they doing?
They can't stop crying.
Yeah. On Steamcliff Road, within the drong, so the note will tell you that means narrow way, up where, as folk do pass along, the turnin' style, a painted white do sheen by day, and show by night. So there's one place where they particularly wept. Where was that? At the turnstile, yeah, the white turnstile. For always there, as we did go to church, thick style did led us through. So always there, when we went to church, that style, that turnstile, did let us through, with spreading arms that wheeled to guide us each in turn to t'other side. So they would get to the turnstile, what would happen?
One by one.
One by one. Yeah, in the turnstile, they would go one by one. And first of all, the train, he took my wife with winsome gait and look. So he, very interesting pronoun. So when they got to the turnstile, who went through first?
The wife.
Yeah. And took there is a little bit maybe anxious-making to the reader. But just a standard description, she's the turnstile takes her first, she goes through first. If you know she's dead, you might see took there as a stronger word. But literally, she goes first with winsome gait and look, and then went on my little maid a-skippin' onward, or then sent on my little maid a-skippin' onward over jade to reach again the place of pride, her comely mother's left-hand side. So his daughter goes next, and she's really happy to rush through the turnstile and get back to the side of her mother. So beautiful description. A place of pride, which is her comely mother's left-hand side. And then a wheeling round, he took on me within his third white nook. So the third person to go through the turnstile is Barnes, yeah. And then a fourth, and in the fourth, a shaken wild, he sent us on our giddy child. So the fourth person to go through the turnstile is who?
His son.
His son, who is now dead. But yesterday, he guided slow my downcast Jenny full of woe. So yesterday they buried their child. If it really is literally yesterday, if it's again a little bit like the tomorrow in Bronte. But yesterday he guided slow my downcast Jenny full of woe. So that same church road. But now they go through the turnstile, and first Jenny goes through full of woe, and then my little maid in black, a walking softly on her track, not rushing to be with her, but walking softly. And after he'd have turned again to let me go along the lane, so he's the third one again going through the turnstile, he had no little boy to fill his last white arms, and they stood still. So, of course their eyes are full of tears. That fourth person going through the turnstile, not anymore. So this is written years later, but it's worth thinking about all the things a turnstile means. The turning of time, the landscape, which, like in the previous poem that we just looked, changes. It used to be that he looked at this road, this turnstile, this place in one way, and now it's the nature is the same, the landscape is the same, but everything is different. Yeah.
I think kind of compared to a lot of other Victorian poetry, you could almost write the same poem with the same effect, but literally with a subway station and a turnstile.
Yeah, I think you could.
Which is kind of transcendent.
Yes. Yeah, that's great. All right, if you anyone who wants to, for a little extra credit, do it. Modernize this. Yeah, yes. There's a great contemporary poet called Alice Notley. I don't know if people know who she is. But she has an amazing poem, a book-length poem called The Descent of Alette, which is a kind of Dantesque poem about going to the underworld, but the underworld is all set on a subway. It's a little bit like Snowpiercer, except a New York subway. As hell. And that's where you go and can't return from. So just that's just a footnote. But yeah, do it. If you wanna do a modern version of this, that would be terrific.
Was his daughter okay or
no. Oh, I'm not sure about his daughter. I think she was, yes.
Because it's kind of an ominous picture that, you know, she goes after the wife.
Yeah. I mean, in a sense it doesn't matter because they'll all die.
That's true.
I mean, the turnstile here then also means a turnstile to the land of death. And you can only go one way. So what had been just a happy toy is now turning into this grim allegory of what happens. And then there's the emptiness of that last quarter circle where his son had been. Okay, have a good weekend. I will tomorrow, because I didn't bring my book today, I will scan and send you the next 50 pages, but I really hope you'll have the book soon.
Tomorrow, I think. Let's go tomorrow.
Sorry, we don't have class tomorrow. I'll send it to you.
Yeah, no, I'm just kidding about your tomorrow.
Oh, right. Tomorrow you will all have the book, right? In some tomorrow. Okay, see you next week.
What about the poetry 100 lines memorization?